Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. And don't forget that we're moving to 101.1 FM. If you haven't already retuned your radio dials, please do so. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Leslie Satan, who's a dancer mounting a piece this weekend. And we're also going to be speaking with Mike Lofton, who's the director of HomeWise, talking about affordable housing. Right now, I would like to welcome the wonderful people from Creativity for Peace. Dottie Indyke is the president, and we have three girls at the table with us. Noy Kochba from Israel, Diana Freijef, who's Palestinian from the West Bank, and Vara Darafshi, who is Arab-Israeli. All of them are here to join us and tell us about this amazing event and happening. Welcome, ladies.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Dottie, first of all, tell us about this program, Creativity for Peace. What is it?
Creativity for Peace brings Palestinian and Israeli girls, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, and Druze from the Middle East to Santa Fe every summer for a three-week peace camp, and then continues the program of peacemaking in the Middle East throughout the rest of the year. And the purpose of our program is all for girls ages 15, 16, and then we have a young leaders program where former campers come back and work with us as counselors and also continue to do leadership development in the Middle East.
And all the girls here are actually young leaders.
That's correct. The three girls at the table are all former campers who are acting as junior counselors at our camp this summer. And the purpose of our program is not only to build friendships between traditional enemies, but also to help girls develop the leadership skills that they need to be future peacemakers in their countries.
How long has this program been going on?
We established the program in 2003. This is our fifth summer of hosting camps. We have had 85 girls go through the program. This summer we have 15 girls here in town. And then, so after the summer we'll have 100 girls who have been campers.
And this is a program that you plan to continue indefinitely, and the girls who are now 15 will be 30 15 years from now, come back. This will be like planting a seed for their work later.
That's exactly right. It would be wonderful if we didn't have to do this program anymore, because that would mean that there would be peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But yes, otherwise, we are, we're going to continue the program indefinitely, and we're going to continue to nurture our girls so that we give them the support they need to be the future leaders of their countries.
Talk about some of the activities that you do during the day.
We start with the breakfast, of course, and then we're going to the dialogue room. There we're talking about all of the problems that we have, all of our feelings, and we have art almost every day. We're creating a lot of beautiful things.
What happens in the dialogue room?
What happens in the dialogue room is everyone have to share their story, you know, their feeling, their intention, and talk about themselves and learn how to listen, compassion listening, and also how to respect the other side and be more understanding.
Has it been difficult to learn to really listen to the people who traditionally are thought of as your enemies?
At the first two or three dialogues, I think, yeah, it's really difficult, but we have to, I think.
You also do things like ropes courses and physical activities. What is that like?
It's so much fun. We are going, all of the girls together, and it's bonding experience. We have so much fun together, and we can see that we are the same. We have nothing different.
One of the lines that was said in the movie, Dottie made a 15-minute film about, last year's camp. Somebody said, an enemy is a person whose story you haven't heard, which I thought was a beautiful line.
That's a quote, actually, from Mahatma Gandhi. Yeah. And that's what these girls find out. They come in, I think, with a lot of misconceptions about each other that they've been taught their whole lives. And then they meet And oftentimes they live very close to each other. I mean, it's not a large area, the area of Palestine and Israel, not geographically a very large area. So many of these girls live quite close to each other but have no opportunity to be able to be together. They come all the way here, and then they find out that they have much more in common than not.
What are some of the things that you found that you had in common with people that surprised you?
Actually, I have a lot of common being living in Arab Israeli, like originally Palestinian, but living in Israel. I have a lot of stuff in common with Israel people and Palestinian people. First of all, my ancestors are Palestinian, so that's the major common thing between me and Palestinians. And I have an Israel citizenship, so I'm part of Israel too. So I have a lot of stuff in common with both sides.
And you must speak multiple languages.
Yeah, I speak Arabic, Hebrew, and English.
Is it required for everybody who comes into this camp to speak pretty good English? I mean, that is your common language.
Yes, yes, everybody has to speak English. And the girls have different levels of fluency, but we conduct the camp. The dialogues are done in English, and we try to keep the girls in English as much as we can, although it's not entirely possible all the time. I mean, that is the common language, and that is a way to bridge a lot of gaps. Everybody has to try to speak a common language.
You did the program last year, Noy?
No, 2 years ago.
A couple of years ago. When you went back, did you meet the girls, did you get together with the girls who you knew from camp?
Yeah, of course. We meet all the time, and I met, like, Diana and Bara in Israel. And Diana and Bara wasn't in my session of the camp, so we have a lot of meeting in Israel during the year.
And Diana, you also you saw some of the girls who you met in previous years.
Yeah, of course. We have like this camp like program for a whole year. Like we have to meet each other like every month, and it's really, really exciting.
How do your parents and your elders feel about these meetings with people that you might not normally meet once you go home? Are they happy that you have Jewish friends who are coming to your house, Israeli friends?
Yeah, of course, because before the first Intifada, we had a lot of Jewish friends, like family, and it's okay for us.
And what about you?
Yeah, my family and friends are really excited about me staying here and doing this kind of thing. They are really supported, and they really want to meet the girls, and I invite all of the girls to my house.
What is your life like on the West Bank? What is your daily life like?
Actually, we have nothing there. Like, only I have to go to school and come back home. Like, we don't have a normal life like here in USA. And neither the Israeli side, they don't have a normal life. So that's it.
What do you do when you come home from school?
Nothing. Just stay at home. Yeah.
And if you go out, it's too dangerous?
Like, we can't go out so at the night because it's really dangerous. Maybe some soldiers or tanks will attack the city. And we can't go to the other city because it takes like 4 or 3 hours. And it's only take before the Intifada, like 20 minutes. So it's really hard.
What is your life like, Noy, in Israel?
Also, we are going to school, getting back. And you can go out, but it's a little scary that if you go out on a public bus, so maybe something will happen. So
what city do you live in?
I live in Moshav. It's called Moshav Kahal. It's in the north of Israel, so it's kind of safe. But still, when you want to go out, you want to go out to the big city. And my mother don't let me go on public buses.
Bara, what is your life like as an Arab Israeli living in Israel?
Actually, it's a pretty hard life because as an Arab Israeli, Arabs are a minority in Israel. So, unfortunately, we don't have our full rights in Israel. So, like, when we go to school, we have to work twice as hard in order to get to college. We don't have that
just
much...
Just because of discrimination?
Of course, yeah. We don't have that much activities or clubs in our villages. Our villages are in a pretty bad shape. We don't have, like, the local councils don't have that big budgets to do something. So it is a pretty hard life, sort of.
How have you been able to help the next group of girls because of the leadership training that you got when you were at the camp the first time?
Well, as an Arab Israeli, seeing both sides suffering and just being stuck in the middle, it was pretty impossible for me to believe that one day there might be peace, or like I could see an Israeli girl and a Palestinian girl just tugging. And last year when I came to the camp and after dialogue, I saw everybody hugging and crying together. It was like, wow. So I decided that it's a mission that I have to go on with. And here I am to just, and as an Arab Israeli, I'm sort of a bridge. I understand both languages. So there won't be misunderstanding between both sides. So, yeah.
And what have you learned, Noy, that you're able to pass on to the younger campers?
That we have so much common things. We love the same stuff. We are doing the same stuff in the same way. We eat the same food. We have so much things in common, more than things that we don't have in common. So we can be friends. Definitely we can be friends.
Deanna, what have you learned that you can give to the younger girls who come to the camp?
When I was a camper last year, I was very extreme in my thoughts. And this year, when I see the young girls like me, I really feel excited and happy because they will be like me now. I really believe in peace. And I'm here to support them, to make them more understand each other, and just to be with them.
Yeah, these girls, one of the important things that these girls do is they lead by example. When we're in dialogue and the girls are crying and they're angry at each other and they feel discriminated against and they feel like there's no understanding of their suffering.
And that comes up in camp, in the dialogues, in the activities?
It comes up in the dialogue. That's where it's supposed to come up. And we try to keep it only in the dialogue and then have fun the rest of the time or use our art making to express, you know, our inner thoughts and feelings. But when that comes up in dialogue, these young leaders are able to say, I was here with you. I was in the same place as you. I was hurt and I was angry. And I learned that there's a way to have understanding. They give the girls a lot of hope because they've been through the process and they've come out the other side. What Deanna said about how she came and she was a pretty extreme voice. She had a very strong kind of extreme position. And now she is totally committed to peace. When she goes into the dialogue, she talks with the girls about how important it is for them to focus on both the positive as well as the negative, how important it is. And coming from someone like her who has come such a long way herself personally, that's a powerful example.
What training do the counselors have who are facilitating these meetings? Because that's not necessarily an easy job.
No, it's not an easy job at all.
Are you one of the people who does that?
I don't do that. No, I don't do that. That's not my job. My job is to run the organization, raise the money, make sure that everything is in place so that we can have an organization. Our facilitators actually are all trained by Rachel Kaufman, who is the founder of the organization. Rachel has been a facilitator for 30 years or 40 years. And She has developed her own style of facilitation, plus she has trained in nonviolent communication and compassionate listening and many other techniques. And then she has, in turn, trained our facilitators. The main facilitator this year is Anna L. Harpaz. Anna L. has been working with our organization since the beginning. She's a Jewish Israeli, and she's completely committed to this process. And we also have another facilitator, Sylvie Mardia, who is an Arab Israeli, who actually just was having health problems this year, so is not with us this summer. But we're going to continue to train facilitators. And actually, my hope is that some of our young leaders will become our future facilitators.
This program has been going on for 5 years. What are some of the things you've learned and perhaps changes that you've made in the organization as a result of the experience you've had?
Oh, many changes, many. I mean, we started off, we didn't know even what we were getting into necessarily. I mean, we had it was a much less sophisticated process. We've done a lot of refinements around how we run the dialogue, how we structure the dialogues to make them the most effective that they can be, and we're constantly making changes to that.
The dialogue seems to be the real linchpin to the whole process.
Well, it is, because that's where the girls express their real deep pain. That's the safe place for them to cry and express how painful it is to live in war, how they feel discriminated against, how they're afraid, how they have to live in fear, how painful it is to lose members of your family. And many of these girls have had personal losses, very close personal losses, best friends, relatives. And it's also about understanding, like, the language. Like, you know, to one side, a person is a suicide, is a terrorist. To another side, that same person is a freedom fighter. The army, the Israeli army, I mean, has a lot of connotations and brings up a lot of feelings for girls on both sides, different feelings. And the dialogue is the place where people, the girls, can say, this is how much pain I feel. This is the experience. And in the process, everyone learns that everyone is suffering. Everyone is suffering on both sides. And then I think that is a very important lesson for the girls to learn.
Why did the organization choose to have girls only?
There's a lot of reasons. The philosophical reason is that we believe girls are natural peacemakers. And so we focus on girls because we feel like the girls are more suited, perhaps, to being the next generation of peacemakers. Girls are going to be mothers, and mothers pass on values to their children. But on a practical level, it would also be very, very difficult for us to get boys, especially out of Palestine. It would be difficult, very difficult. Unfortunately, I'm sorry that that's the case, because boys could be benefit. There are other peace camps in North America that do have boy participants. We're a small camp, intimate. I mean, Seeds of Peace, which is a peace camp in Maine, is many, many times larger than us. And they also involve countries all over the Middle East, not just Palestine and Israel. Ours is very focused on the Palestinian and Israeli conflict in specific, and also in girls. And also we use art, which that's unique to us.
And the use of art, I mean, the feeling I get is so many emotions come up during these dialogues, and art is a wonderful way to calm and also to express those feelings.
Right. Maybe you guys can say something about
that.
What
is the art like for you, Diana? Or Noi?
It's really a way to relax, to let your feeling go out and express yourself. You can make out with your feelings, not only with your hands. You take off the feelings.
And also they, like, Jewish and Palestinian work as a partner, that is really important thing. And also we have, beside the art and the activity, like, to build trust between each other, like, it's very, very important for them.
So there are games and exercises that are specifically about trust building.
Yeah.
What are they like?
Like rope scores. Like, there's the partner, one Jewish and one Israel, one Palestinian. And what the name of the egg things? There's a play, like, we have to keep the egg in the pipe.
Oh, that's right. I saw that on the film. That everybody holds a piece of half pipe,
uh-huh.
And an egg sort of goes downhill, and everybody's holding a piece of the pipe, and they
really
have to
exciting.
Let the egg not fall on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
They also sleep in the same rooms with each other. Yeah, and one of the things that can be very disconcerting to girls when they first arrive is that we have the girls living in a 5-bedroom home, and they, Palestinians, have to sleep sometimes in the same bed with a Jewish Israeli. So that is another way that some major bonding happens. And
what is the artwork, doing the art like for you, Bara?
I believe that art is like expressing yourself and your feelings, but without using words. You just hold the pens or the colors or the paint or whatever and just draw around just to get your emotions out.
Yeah, our art program is run by art therapists. So the director of our art program is Val Carpenter, who lives here in Santa Fe. And the art program is not just art. It's not art to make beautiful art. It's art with a content that directly relates to the dialogue that we do. So girls would work, for example, on making masks of each other's faces or making a collage about peace and war together so that there's not only the element of working together, cooperating, and learning to trust and do teamwork together, but there's also the opportunity in the substance of the work itself to do some more healing around the division.
And we're talking about Creativity for Peace, which also has some public programs coming up.
Yes. We have a camp open house, so if people would like to come out and meet our campers and take a tour of the land, and the campers do a presentation, and they show the art that they've made, and we have nice refreshments. That's on Sunday, August 19th at 3:30 in the afternoon. And people could contact me at dottie@creativityforpeace.com. That's D-O-T-T-I-E at creativityforpeace.com if they were interested in coming. And then on Monday, August 20th, we're doing a collaboration with the Center for Contemporary Arts. We're going to show a film, an Academy Award-nominated documentary called Promises, which is about, focuses on seven young people, younger than our campers, boys and girls, from Palestine and Israel, and their individual lives, and then the opportunity they have to meet with each other. It was made about 4 years, 5 years ago. We're going to screen that film, and then after the screening, our campers are going to get up on stage and our young leaders, and we're going to do a live question and answer with the audience. So that's on Monday, August 20th at 7 o'clock at CCA.
And if you want more information on any of that, you can go to creativityforpeace.com, and it's all presumably on the website.
Well, actually, I don't know if it is. So if you want information, the best thing to do is email me directly, dottie@creativityforpeace.com.
It's just about time to go. If you, Bara, could say anything to the Israeli leadership, the country where you live, what would you say?
Probably that peace is possible, no matter how much you lost, no matter how much you're suffering, peace is possible.
And what about you?
I really agree with what Bara said. We really, really believe in peace after the camp, and especially now as a young leader, so we'll send the message.
And Diana, if you could say anything to the Palestinian leadership, what would you say?
I would say, like Bara said, that the peace is possible, and we have to forgive each other and look toward the peace. And because just thinking about our suffering and complaining makes the situation worse. And we should work for peace. And this is my message for all world, not for Palestinians.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dottie Indyk is the president of Creativity for Peace. Noy Kochba is with us from Israel. Diana Freisha is Palestinian from the West Bank. Bara Darafshi is an Arab-Israeli. Ladies, you're wonderful. Thanks so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Leslie Satan about her dance performance coming up. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Leslie Satan. She's a dancer whose piece, Set in Stones, is being performed this weekend at the Rail Yard Performance Center. It's on Friday and Saturday, August 10th and 11th, sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Arts. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Hello.
Hi. So this is two pieces, a workshop piece and a piece that is, a duet, you and one other dancer. Mm-hmm. Tell us, first of all, about the workshop piece. You've done workshop pieces quite a bit.
Yes, and this one is the second in a row, the second summer in a row that I've done a workshop that meets six times. And in that six times, we make the whole piece from beginning to end. This one has nine area dancers and performers. Most of the people in it actually have dance experience. A few have other arts experience. Almost everyone has experience in the visual as well as performance arts. And we began with an exercise in which I asked people to find something that they would like to do for a really long time. And from there...
What do you mean by a really long time?
Well, actually, we began with a score from 1963 from the Fluxus artist Dick Higgins. And the score was scream as loudly as possible for as long as possible.
Oh, dear.
And that really is what he did. But I wasn't expecting people to scream, though that would have been an option. What people did, as I recall, on the first meeting was they moved in ways that they found pleasurable or engaging for a long time. And then what we did was a series of exercises and assignments in which people experimented with whatever it was with which they'd come up with another person and teaching other people their material, changing their own material in some way that made it more involving for them. And these little vignettes, so to speak, began. And then we did a few things that involved everybody, and those things included a kind of strict improvisation game and also one little section that's actually choreographed. And then these parts were arranged, and they've come together, I think, rather beautifully.
When you're working with non-dancers, non-professionals, or people with some dance experience but limited, you have to work in a different way than if you're working with professional dancers. And how do you make it come together? You and I were talking about yesterday, when that magic happens, something bursts mm-hmm. open.
Well, in this instance, first of all, some of these people are not even remotely neophytes. They're people with significant experience. And this isn't a dance piece per se. The workshop itself was billed as an inter-arts workshop, and that's the kind of thing that I teach normally.
Inter-arts meaning?
Meaning, actually, that's a great question, because there's inter-arts, there's interdisciplinary work, there's intermedia. These are all variations on the theme of bringing things together, bringing forms together in ways that foreground not only the ways that they mesh, but the ways that they are separate from each other. So sometimes you find things that don't come together in obvious ways, but more in ways that each viewer's mind finds on his or her own. So, and as you and I were talking about yesterday, again, certain kinds of work is likely to sweep you away, say, with a certain kind of energy or great beauty and immediacy in the movement itself. I don't honestly think that that is what this is. This is more really involving, quietly involving with what people are actually doing, with the ways that they're connecting to each other, with the ways that they're connecting to objects. That's a big part of this. And simply the way that they focus in performance.
Quiet is, I guess, a word that one would use. You don't use very much music.
That is true. That is true. And again, in the workshop piece, because it isn't a dance piece per se, the role of music wouldn't be the same as in a traditional dance in any case. But in my own work, in my own choreography, I typically don't use music, or if I do use it, I don't use it to dance to. It's simply another presence in the general scene.
What is the aesthetic behind that? You're using music that you don't dance to. It's just something more background, or just one of the elements in the scene.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it background. One of the elements is more how I think of it. And in dance history terms, this directly goes to John Cage and Merce Cunningham and their many years of work together, in which they saw very clearly that each of those practices, dance and music, had its own rhythm, and that there was no need for one of them to depend on the other, and for one of them to go along with the demands of the other.
So that is counterintuitive to a lot of our listeners, for whom dance and music are inextricably linked.
Well, I absolutely...
Especially rhythmic dance.
Yes.
Rhythmic music.
Exactly. And certainly, if I'm if I'm social dancing, I want that. I want to follow the sound of either rock and roll or salsa or whatever it is. But that's not what I'm doing in this work. In this new piece that I'm doing, which is called Set in Stones, there is sound, but the sound isn't music. The sound is a person speaking.
So tell us more about that. You've got the sound of a person speaking. I mean, it's not what you would call sound per se, like running water. It's content. It's meaning.
Right, but it's also sound. And one of the ways that the person who is reading is doing that, and the person is Kiki Jadis. I've asked her to think about it in terms of the texture of the sound so that she can adjust what she's reading. It's not there the way that a research paper would be there. It's there to provide another part of the texture of the evening.
What is the nature of the words that she is saying and the communication between the two of you on stage?
Well, without giving away too much, let's say that these pieces that she's reading all in one way or another either have to do with the idea of memory or are evocative of particular memories that, however directly or indirectly, connect to either what I'm doing or what is happening on the videotapes.
Now, there's videotapes as part of this whole thing as well.
Yes, this actually began. This piece began with video. A year ago, Ian Rosenkrantz videotaped me improvising in a meadow, and we knew that that wasn't going to be a piece. That was going to be raw material. We gave that video footage to Andrew Gorian, who is my video partner in New York, and he made something new out of it. And he not only used Ian's imagery, but he incorporated imagery of Susan York's sculptural pieces, which are part of the set of this piece.
And they look like stones, and therefore it's called Set in Stones.
They look like stones. Two of them actually sort of look like stones. Two of them look like stones only in another universe, but they are, in my mind, the stones of this piece.
We're talking to Leslie Staton. Her performance is this Friday and Saturday, August 10th and 11th at
the Rail Yard.
At the Rail Yard. At what time?
At 8 o'clock.
At 8 o'clock, sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Arts. Now, you're a professor at New York University and at Bard College. What are your students like? Are they students of dance history, students of dance, both?
There's a mix, and when I'm teaching something like dance history, mostly my students are people involved in dance, but not always. And sometimes the students, when they've had a rich career, have some knowledge in one or another area of dance, but they don't necessarily know about other elements of dance. And so that's usually very enriching to find out more of the context of the work they've been doing for so many years. With very young dancers, often there's no sense of where any of this came from.
They're doing it, but they don't know what underlies it.
Right, exactly. And but I also teach workshops that bring dance and other arts together, similar to the workshop that I'm doing here, but spread over a full term and including academic readings in the experimental arts of the 20th century and in some instances the 19th century.
How are the students coming in? What is their preparation and what is their background like? Are they very virtuosic dancers by the time they get to college?
Well, in a conservatory setting, you have dancers who are very virtuosic. I don't teach in the conservatory part of NYU. I teach at the Gallatin School, which is an interdisciplinary department. And what that means is that I never know who's going to be in a class. And
kind of like your workshop here.
Kind of like the workshop here. But the dancers typically are in a college class are generally traditional college age, not always. The other school in which I've been teaching for many years, which is part of the SUNY system, is more adults. So I've worked with many students across levels and ages over the years doing this work.
Why did you choose the Rail Yard Performance Center? It's a big space where a lot of dance classes are taught and a lot of things going there. It's one flat floor. It's not usually, I guess it's a performance space kind of, but it's more of a dance
studio.
Dance studio.
I actually like it very much. It's a beautiful space. It's very light. It's always reminded me of the Cunningham Studio in New York because of being this very broad expanse of pale wood floor. You're absolutely right. It's not a theatrical space per se. And so we make the adjustments to that.
So the performance is called Set in Stones. It's this Friday and Saturday, August 10th and 11th, sponsored by the Center for Contemporary Arts. It's at 8 o'clock both nights, and it's at the Rail Yard Performance Center.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Leslie Staton.
Thank you very much. Bye.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking about affordable housing with the folks from HomeWise. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Mike Lofton. He's the executive director of HomeWise. Now, HomeWise exists to help people who otherwise couldn't afford home ownership and helps them find ways to own. What are the ways that you do it?
Well, we help people in a lot of different ways. A big way is making sure people get a low-interest mortgage loan, get down payment assistance, eliminate mortgage insurance, which is a big cost, and then help them find an affordable home. And they're, you know, even though it's hard in Santa Fe, as you know, the
I was going to say, it's very tricky in Santa Fe.
Yeah. But there's some out there, and there's some affordable homes, and we're very good at hooking you up with something that's in your price range.
How much has the price of housing gone up since you started doing this work?
Oh, geez. I think when I started doing this work, you could buy a home in Casa Solana for about $120,000.
And that was how long ago?
That'd be like, 14 years ago. That home now is probably about $450,000, yeah.
So that's a huge increase. I mean, forget about the cost of living hasn't gone up that much. I mean, the wages haven't gone up that much to keep up with the cost of living, much less high housing prices. Why have they gone up so much?
Well, Santa Fe's it's a nice place to live. We all love living here, and lots of people.
It's always been a nice place to live.
But lots of people have moved here who didn't make their money in New Mexico. It's not that they can afford that home because they're making a high wage. Because they have money from somewhere else, or they sold a home in California, and they have equity, and so that pushes up home prices. Because you got a big demand for housing here, most of which is from people who have money from elsewhere.
This is a story in the town where my mother lives. It's a story in the town in so many places all over the United States. You see an influx of wealth from the outside. Then local people like teachers, police, firemen, and so on, other municipal employees can't afford to live in the town that they serve. We have that here.
A big problem here. So 60% of our police force doesn't live in the city.
60%?
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So it's huge. Like, over half the SWAT team, which needs to respond to emergencies, takes over 45 minutes to get to an emergency from home because they live in Rio Rancho or Albuquerque. So, it's a big problem when you don't have, emergency responders or, emergency room nurses. They need to get to the hospital right away if there's a crisis. So it really hurts the community when, the teachers in public schools, 20%, about 6-7 years ago, 20% of teachers left every year. And when they did a survey, they all said it was because of the cost of living, which was housing costs. So that's why we at HomeWise started a program called TeacherWise to help teachers buy a home. Now we've helped a little over 100 teachers buy a home. And that's really stabilized. So the turnover is really reduced. So that's good for the school.
So it's actually made a difference.
Huge difference.
Is it just teachers, or do you work with other municipal employees, emergency responders, and so on at HomeWise?
No, we're working with several police officers right now to help find a home. It's a hard thing because we don't have enough affordable housing in Santa Fe. So, but anyone who, basically, if you make below $80,000 a year, there's some kind of help available for you. And so, basically, if you make around $21,000 up to $80,000, there's something HomeWise can do to help you buy a home.
What are those things?
Well, like I said before, like down payment assistance, finding an affordable home.
Payment assistance means somebody else will actually pay the down payment?
Yeah.
Where's that money coming from?
We get some federal money to do that, government money to do that. When we build a home, see, a lot of times when you build a home, what it costs you to build a home and what that home is really worth in the market is a huge difference between that. So what we do is we charge you what it costs to build the home, and instead of paying the whole appraised value.
What is the difference? Let's say there's a house that on the market would cost $400,000. What does it cost to build that house?
Well, there's a lot of variables, like what did you pay for the land and all that, but if just the home itself, so if it's a 1,200 square foot house, you know, you might be costing about $120,000 to build that house.
And they would sell it for four.
And then you have land costs on top of that. And, yeah, so it's, yeah, so like, you know, the homes in Casa Solana, they're 1,200, 1,300 square feet. Well, when those were built, they were sold for like $18,000.
Right.
But it's.
That's a 60s development?
Yeah. Yeah, late 50s, early 60s. You know, and they're great homes, but they're 1,200 square feet.
Right.
So the fact that they're selling for $450 now, I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. We're talking to Mike Lofton, Executive Director of HomeWise. Another situation that we have in Santa Fe is that a lot of people have bought houses and they don't live in them.
This is true. And there's, the city did a very good needs assessment. And Kathy McCormick at the Office of Affordable Housing is the one that put this needs assessment together. And they found that like 16% of all homes in Santa Fe are owned by out-of-town owners, right? So they have second homes. In certain parts of town, like on the north side, it's like almost 40% of all the homes are owned by people who don't live in
the north side being what? What place or roads are we talking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not exactly sure the boundaries, but my guess is probably north of where we're sitting, north of Cordova. And then, you know, when you look at the east side, then it's like 23%, I think, of homes are owned by out-of-town owners. So
the north side, that's unbelievable. Almost half, 40%
right.
of the houses,
right.
people buy them, they don't live in
right.
them.
Yeah.
They come here a few months a year.
Or maybe not even.
Maybe you know. Not even.
Yeah. So that creates a lot, to your earlier question, that creates a lot of pressure, upward pressure on the housing market when people are buying homes as second homes. When you look at what homes sell for, of all the homes in the city that sell for over $650,000, 40% of those homes are owned by out-of-towners, right? So the more expensive the home, the more likely it is to be owned by someone who doesn't live here permanently.
Now, there's, of course, all the discussion about short-term rentals, but a lot of those houses are owned by people who don't even need to do short-term rentals. They just leave them sitting empty.
Right.
And probably it's the people who actually can't afford to leave it empty who would be, who have to deal with doing rentals in order to even be able to afford it and retire there later.
Right.
So you are doing all sorts of programs. You're also doing affordable housing development.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of those projects.
Well, what we do is, first of all, we don't care what home people buy. We'll help you buy whatever home you want. So if you want to buy an existing home on the Bell in the neighborhood, we're going to help you find the home that you want. So, but in order to add to your choices, we also, HomeWise, will build homes. So right now we have a proposal to build 50 homes near Quail Run, next to Quail Run on Old Las Vegas Highway. That's a really exciting project for us because there's very little affordable housing, as you know, on the east side, and very new affordable homes have been built on the east side. About 16 of them have been built over the last 9 years on the east side. So this will be...
That's not much.
We'll over triple the number of affordable homes that get built if this project gets approved, which goes to the city council
tonight
for approval.
How is the neighborhood responding so far?
Well, I think there's some people in the neighborhood who get it and think that, you know, having a police officer living in their neighborhood would be a good thing. There's some folks, a lot in Quail Run, who are really concerned about it and are not real excited about affordable housing in their neighborhood. And then some of the people in the county, like at Arroyo Hondo, there's some folks who have said that they don't want to see housing as they come into the last historic gateway down Old Pecos Trail.
That would hurt their eyes.
Yes, but you don't even, like, actually when you come in from Old Pecos Trail, you don't even see it because it's pretty far to the east of Old Pecos Trail, so you wouldn't even see it. But I think that's more just of, you know, trying to find a reason to oppose it.
When I moved to Santa Fe, which was a long time ago in the early 90s, one of the things that struck me compared to places that I'd lived before, I lived in Boston, was how mixed the neighborhoods were, how there were people of different, you know, class, race, and income levels living among each other. And it seemed Santa Fe seemed to absorb people in a way that I just hadn't seen elsewhere. Is it still like that, or has Santa Fe become more stratified in terms of who lives where?
Well, I think it's definitely become more stratified, but I mean, it's still a very good virtue of Santa Fe that there are neighborhoods where it's very mixed, and where, you know, a guy living on Social Security is living next to a guy who owns a $1 million home, and you know, you see that on some of the east side, and usually they're older families who bought the, or you know, inherited the home a long, long time ago. You know, some of these homes are, you know, the streets, like there's a, we helped an older woman rehab her home, do home improvements on her home on Placita Rafaela. Her name's Rafaela, and it was her grandmother that the name, where the name for the street came from. And they're still there. And I go, like, did you ever think about selling? She goes, it's worth a lot of money, but where am I going to go? So it's like, it's a thing that's wonderful about Santa Fe is that people have embraced each other in many ways and live side by side. And it's unfortunate that, you know, that's what I think we're fighting for, is to try to get new homes that working people can live in on the east side, help people keep old family homes on the east side. You know, I think it's something that's very important for all of us.
There's also a huge increase in the amount of mobile homes or trailers. Does HomeWise work with that kind of housing or not?
Well, it depends. I mean, in some mobile homes and manufactured housing is, you know, it's an interesting thing. So if you, what we don't support is manufactured housing when you rent the lot, because it's a real loser. You always lose money. The mobile home depreciates in value. Your rent goes up on the lot typically. You never get ahead. What's interesting and surprising to many is a mobile home, if you own the land, does appreciate in Santa Fe in value. So it's, what I would say is owning a mobile home when you own the land is a step above renting, but probably not as good as owning a regular home.
Well, don't most of the developments require that you rent the land? I mean, they're not selling those little parcels of land.
Some of them do. Some of them sell the lots. Many of them are rental. And those rental lots, I mean, it is a real, financially, it's a real loser. I mean, our HomeWise's take on home ownership is what's important about it. It's not that it's just shelter, but it's the way Americans develop some financial security. It's their nest egg. It's why my mom is comfortable in retirement. It's because she paid off her home a long time ago. She doesn't have a housing payment anymore.
So, and does she live in the same house that you grew up in?
Same house, yeah, in Albuquerque. And so she's, you know, and she was a secretary for UNM, right? So, I mean, she wouldn't make a lot of money, but because she paid her house off a long time ago, she's lived rent-free for a long time and, you know, can, on Social Security and a small pension, can live okay. So we really see home ownership as a way for people. It's a way you send your kids to college. It's a way you do a lot of things. So if you do it in the right way. So we really believe that you want people to get equity in their home. It's their nest egg. And
do you offer classes to people?
Yeah, we have classes on how to buy a home, and they're free classes. We do and it's very thorough. We have the people that do the training are experienced, and they're adult educators, so they know, you know, how to, you know, making some of the stuff interesting is not an easy thing to do. and so they make it very interesting and make it something that, so people retain knowledge. We also do financial fitness classes, because one of the barriers to home ownership is, you know, your financial management. And if you can save some money and not have a lot of debt and pay your bills on time, you're going to get a much better deal on a mortgage. Your purchasing power on a home is going to be greater. So we spend a lot of time with people improving their financial situation.
Mike Lofton, it's great to have you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great. Well, thank you.
Mike Lofton is the executive director of HomeWise, and the telephone number over at HomeWise is
983-6214.
983-6214. Ladies and gentlemen, of course, as always, if you've missed any telephone numbers or any other information, you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. As I just said, you can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org, or you can also leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting. The website there is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, including archived shows going back almost to the beginning of the year, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan. We'll be graced by a visit from piano star Kevin Hayes, and Giants of Jazz features Branford Marsalis. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow we'll be talking to Forest Guardians. We will see you then. Keep your radio dial tuned to 101.1 FM or KSFR.org. Hasta la vista. Ciao.